regularly expelled from France, Italy, Portugal, Sweden, the United States, and other countries for industrial espionage and the like. One of the most notable of those companies was Sebeco S.A., which was founded in 1982, according to Belgium's Le Soir, as a cover for the Soviet services by Boris Bichstein, who had a close business relationship with the Solntsevskaya Bratva's Sergei Mikhailov. But now that the Soviet Union was dying, desperate measures were called for. After all, what would happen if their embassies were shut down? The Russians wanted to have intelligence officers in country even if the embassy was down, says John Cipher, who spent 28 years in the CIA's clandestine service, which included serving in Moscow and running the CIA's Russian operations. So, in addition to having legal residents who were intelligence officers in embassies, they had illegal residents who might appear to be French citizens living in France or Finnish citizens in France, but they were fake. They were really Russians. It was an incredible amount of work to give these people real backgrounds, languages, passports, and real businesses. But as the Soviet Union fell apart, Khrushchev wanted to make sure he had Russians in other countries working for Russian businesses that were self-supporting and could support intelligence activities. So in March 1991, after the Baltic states and other republics split off from the USSR, Khrushchev created a plan to launch about 600 companies run by retired KGB officers, often as joint ventures in the Baltics or Israel. All agents in the operation were instructed to do whatever they could to gain a commercial foothold that would enable them to be self-sustaining. The companies were there not merely to provide cover for intelligence operatives. They were there to function as real companies, as major corporations, to make money, to finance operations against the West, to launder money, and to gather intelligence that could be used against the West. This was the kind of expertise that would serve Putin well in the future, as it became clear what shape the new Russia would take. Meanwhile, after the wall fell, Putin moved back to Leningrad in 1990, continued with the KGB, and kept a low profile. According to Oleg Kalugin, who was one of his bosses, within the KGB, Putin was something of a cipher. "He would knock on my door and say, 'Please sign this,'" Kalugin recalled. Otherwise, Kalugin said, Putin did not make much of an impression. His prospects were bleak. "He came from Germany with no job," said Kalugin. "He had to be a cab driver with his own car he brought from East Germany, a Trabant, probably." With its two-cylinder engine and plastic body, the Trabant was referred to as a spark plug with a roof and came to symbolize the demise of the Eastern Bloc. "And he drove for a few months, 6 or 8 months, just earning money." In first person, Putin disputes Kalugin's account, saying, "Kalugin doesn't remember a thing. He couldn't remember me. I had no contact with him, nor did I meet him. It is I who remembers him, because he was a big boss and everybody knew him. Kalugin is a traitor," Putin added. "I saw Kalugin during my time in Leningrad when he was deputy head of the directorate. He was an absolute loafer." Everything had changed. Conventional wisdom had it that the great game was over. The West had won. A classified ad in the International Herald Tribune told the story. "Former KGB agent seeks employment in similar field," it read, accompanied by a phone number. For a brief period that year, Putin took an administrative post at Leningrad State University, a fairly standard cover for a KGB operative. Then, just as the Soviet Union was dissolving, Anatoly Sobchak, a former law professor of Putin's at Leningrad State, became mayor of Leningrad. Leningrad changed its name back to St. Petersburg in 1991. In sync with the changing times of the Gorbachev era, Sobchak had positioned himself as a strong pro-democracy politician But he also knew that the KGB was scrambling to take charge of whatever institutions might survive, including the municipal government in Leningrad. In addition, he was wise enough to realize that he'd be better off if he picked his own deputy from the KGB rather than allowing the KGB to choose the man who would work directly under him. As a result, Sobchak asked Kalugin whom he should hire from the KGB.
"I mentioned a couple of names, but he said they were too highly placed," Kalugin recalled.
Sobchak wanted someone who was not immediately identifiable as a high-profile, hardline KGB operative. So instead, he hired Vladimir Putin, a mere lieutenant colonel, whom he had known when Putin worked at Leningrad State. Putin was still on active reserve with the KGB, which was monitoring the ascent of the new democratic leaders in Russia, and his low profile notwithstanding, the hiring of a KGB bureaucrat by Sobchak was seen as a betrayal. Sobchak portrayed himself as a crusader for freedom and cursed the KGB, said Alexander Shelkanov, who served as chairman of the executive committee of the Leningrad City Council at the time. He then went out and hired a professional KGB operative as his closest deputy. He openly violated his own principles. With the country still very much in crisis, KGB men began turning up at the sides of newly minted oligarchs, government ministers, at the highest levels of power. In Moscow, that included President Boris Yeltsin, who from the first moment he succeeded Gorbachev, found that wherever he went, KGB bodyguards were watching his every move. Similarly, Putin's new job may have been part of a carefully orchestrated KGB operation to penetrate Sobchak's inner circle and that of other pro-democracy politicians.
"This really means that Putin acted on orders from the KGB and was part of an operation that I would call Trojan Horse," said Leonid Dobrovolsky, deputy chairman of the city's food committee.
Even though Putin saw the collapse of the Soviet Union as a disaster, it was the best thing that could have possibly happened to his career. At an extraordinary moment in its history, Russia's newfound lawlessness became a mission worthy of his enormous ambitions, as well as a gigantic opportunity. At the time, hyperinflation had wiped out the savings of millions of people, just as hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Russia's natural resources, gas, oil, metals, timber, and more, were about to be sold off by the state. Food shortages necessitated launching a temporary system of barter operations, in which the city of St. Petersburg traded raw materials, oil, timber, rare metals, and the like, with foreign companies for food. Because St. Petersburg was the first Russian city in which property was privatized, Putin led the way. From his relatively unimpressive perch as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and chair of the External Affairs Committee, KVS, he was given the mandate of encouraging, regulating, and licensing foreign investment in huge, formerly state-owned enterprises. Now that the centralized command structures of the Soviet era were gone, authorities desperately needed new mechanisms to put goods into stores. Putin had acquired the power to determine who could become wealthy. According to Marina Salyo, a former city council member who chaired a commission that investigated missing food imports, Putin made a killing by signing export licenses, despite lacking the proper authority to do so, for various dubious companies. In the process, she said, he doled out more than $120 million in goods to highly suspect people, and the city received nothing in return. Outsiders who were unwilling to go to the dark side didn't stand much of a chance. "This began in an era when selling blue jeans was an economic crime," explained an American businessman who was doing deals in Moscow at the time. "You could go to jail for that. Now, suddenly, there was oil. So I was working with bankers who rose to the top during this period. We had to hire security, thuggish guys who liked to fight.
You had your security, and the other guys had security. It was the Wild West. You had no idea of what was going on. There was the Mogilevich gang and Chechen gangs all fighting gang warfare. I was trying to comply with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but we didn't really know whom we were dealing with or how the system might change. And if you wanted to take over the really big enterprises, you needed the mafia's help. You needed protection. Various mafias stepped in to fill the breach. Azeris, Chechens, Sonseva, the Mogilevich organization, and in St. Petersburg, the Tambov crime gang. The criminals needed export licenses, tax exemptions, below-market rate loans, business visas, and freedom from arrest and prosecution for their crimes. All of this and more was available from Putin and corrupt bureaucrats under him. Money could not go abroad without the approval of Putin's KVS. The same was true for businesses that wanted to be licensed and registered. He also was able to control the movement of money across international borders, all of which put an enormous amount of power in Putin's hands, not Sobchak's. Like Donald Trump, Putin had been well acquainted with mobsters long before he had a political career, thanks to judo coach Leonid Uzviatsov. In 1994, Uzviatsov was killed in a gang dispute, but Putin cemented ties with Tambov through its leader, Vladimir Kumarin, a.k.a. Vladimir Barsakov, who also served as an executive at the Petersburg Fuel Company, which Putin had chosen to be the sole supplier of gasoline for the city. In return, Tambov helped Putin and his cronies control the airport, the seaport, rail stations, and various other choke points through which flowed 20% of all Russian imports and exports. Kumarin is serving a 14-year sentence for money laundering and organizing the illegal takeover of companies in St. Petersburg. Kumarin was also on the board of directors of a subsidiary of SPAG, a German company that had huge real estate holdings in St. Petersburg, and according to the BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German Federal Intelligence Service, was laundering money for Russia's organized crime and also for Colombian drug dealers. According to Newsweek, SPAG executives were indicted for laundering more than $1 million in cash for Colombia's Cali cocaine cartel. Putin served on its advisory board at the time. A Liechtenstein court found two men associated with SPAG, Rudolf Ritter and Eugen von Hofen, guilty of fraud, but acquitted them on charges that they laundered money for the Cali cartel. The presiding judge, however, added that some suspicions remained. By 1994, the Russian economy was in such disarray that a plan called Loans for Shares was instituted through which Russian banks lent the government money in exchange for temporary stakes in the state-owned companies that were to be auctioned off. But once the auctions began, the New York Times reported, it became all too obvious that a fix was in. Foreign investors were barred from bidding for the most desirable assets, and the same banks that were assigned by the government to organize the auctions ended up winning them, and usually at only a fraction over the minimum bid. A tiny elite began to acquire control over a vast number of public enterprises. Oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky got a 78% share of ownership in Yukos, the oil and gas giant, worth about $5 billion, for just $310 million. Boris Berezovsky bought Sibneft, another oil giant, worth $3 billion, for a mere $100 million. A majority stake in Gazprom, the state-owned energy company that controlled a third of the world's gas reserves, was sold for just $230 million, according to an article by James Henry, former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, in the American Interest. Russia's entire national electric grid was privatized for just $630 million. Natural resources such as oil, iron and steel, and aluminum, high-tech arms, airline industries, diamond mines, and most of Russia's banking system went for next to nothing. In all, Russia privatized 150 state-owned companies for just $12 billion. Anatoly Chubais, Russia's first deputy prime minister and the so-called father of Russian privatization, framed the dilemma in stark terms. "We did not, at first, have the choice between socialism and ideal capitalism," he said. "The choice in Russia was between a criminalized transition and civil war." What Russia faced was nothing less than the looting of its natural resources, the betrayal of a capitalist revolution, and the birth of Putin's kleptocracy, an era of unimaginable corruption and greed. It was as if a virus had been injected into the system, spreading and institutionalizing corruption throughout a mafia state run by a kleptocrat who ruled over a web of crooked patronage networks. Before long, the money began to flow. There were real estate transactions, arms sales, shady bank deals, illegal exports, and much more. From the beginning, Putin's friends did well. His judo pals, Arkady and Boris Rothenburg, ended up being co-owners of SGM Stroygazmontaj Group, the largest construction company for gas pipelines and electrical power lines in Russia. Forbes estimated Arkady's wealth at $2.6 billion and Boris's at $1.16 billion. Gennady Timchenko, another judoka pal of Putin's, fared even better as chairman of the Gunvor oil trading firm, with a net worth of $15.6 billion. Anatoly Turchak, yet another judo sparring partner of Putin's, served as deputy to Putin in St. Petersburg. He ended up being the main owner of the Leninets defense plant and was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Others who remained loyal to Putin over the years were rewarded with enormous wealth and key positions during his presidency. Among them, Igor Sechin, who ended up as CEO of Rosneft, the huge Russian oil company, Alexei Miller, CEO of Gazprom, German Greff, CEO of Russia's largest bank, Sberbank, Dmitry Medvedev, who became prime minister and subsequently president, and many others. In their very different ways, Trump and Putin were assembling networks that were essential to their political ambitions. In Trump Tower, Donald had put together a glamorous refuge for celebrities and the super-rich that enabled him to project a highly marketable persona all over the world. As for Putin, he took the idea of the dacha, the seasonal or second home that is so popular among Russians, and personalized it for his own inner circle by assembling the Ozera Dacha Cooperative on the shores of Lake Komsomolskaya as a relaxing weekend retreat for the new privileged Russian elite, including Yeltsin and his family, Tambov crime boss Vladimir Kumarin, who served as the Ozera Co-op's vice president, and a number of oligarchs in the making. Over time, the Ozera Cooperative became so emblematic of Putin's inner circle that in 2014, when the United States and the European Union imposed economic sanctions on Putin's closest associates, no fewer than 8 shareholders in Ozera were sanctioned. Putin's tenure in Sobchak's office was so rife with scandal that it led to a host of investigations into illegal assignment of licenses and contracts by Putin as head of the Committee for Foreign Liaison, collaboration with criminal gangs in regulating gambling, a money laundering operation by the St. Petersburg Real Estate Holding Company, where Kumarin was involved and Putin served on the advisory board, Putin's role in providing a monopoly for the Petersburg Fuel Company, then controlled by the Tambov criminal organization, and much, much more, virtually all of which was whitewashed. But according to Kumarin himself, while he was in St. Petersburg in the 90s, Putin signed many hundreds of contracts, doling out funds to his cronies. One KGB FSB agent who tracked Putin's corruption relentlessly during this period was Alexander Litvinenko, a lieutenant colonel then in his mid-30s, who later wrote about his findings in The Gang from Lyubyanka. Lyubyanka, of course, is the home of the KGB-FSB, and the title is meant to suggest that agents such as Putin were in fact nothing more than gangsters. An avid athlete, Sasha, as his friends called him, had joined the KGB as a young lieutenant to be part of a real team fighting a common enemy, and on the right side, so you think. "I thought I was going to be protecting people from harm," he told a friend. That the agency had a dark past, the gulag, you know, millions of victims, I didn't learn until the 1990s. In the end, Litvinenko discovered that Putin's relationship with the criminal Kumarin Barsikov is currently the number one state secret in Russia. He added that the whole of St. Petersburg knows that Putin is linked to this man by personal friendship and financial ties. When St. Petersburg prosecutors investigated Putin's corruption, they concluded, in 1994, the humble clerk Dmitry Medvedev owned 10% of Europe's largest pulp and paper mill, and this was only Medvedev, Putin's advisor. Can you imagine what kind of money was already owned by his boss? At the time, Medvedev was a consultant to the City Hall's External Affairs Committee, which was headed by Putin. In November 1993, Medvedev became the legal affairs director of Ilim Pulp Enterprise, Russia's largest lumber company, with annual revenues of $500 million. According to Daniel Treisman's The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, Medvedev actually received 20% of the company's stock, not 10%. Medvedev became president of Russia in 2008, after having served as Putin's chief of staff and then as first deputy prime minister. When Putin retook the presidency in 2012, Medvedev became prime minister. Putin himself mysteriously ended up with a villa in Biarritz that was registered to Gennady Timchenko for many years. But that was merely the beginning of a wealth that includes huge stakes in Russia's massive private energy and commodities companies, and that is so vast and so secretive that it could not reliably be calculated. While much of the world thought post-Soviet Russia was struggling with the birth pangs of creating a new democracy, in fact something very different was going on. A kleptocracy was being born. Putin had put himself at the nexus of three worlds, the Chekists, agents of the KGB, FSB, and other state security organizations, the bureaucrats with whom he worked, who were in charge of licensing and regulating companies that had been controlled by the state but were being privatized, and alleged Russian mafiosi, such as the Tambov gang's Vladimir Barsukov, also known as Kumarin. Altogether, Putin's three-legged stool formed a base of operations that was capable of propelling its creator to the highest reaches of power in the new Russian Federation that was rising from the ashes of the Soviet Union. But if Putin was truly to achieve his grandest ambitions, he would need something more, namely an ally who had the power and reach to recruit assets and agents among people of influence deep inside the United States. Chapter 8. Mogilevich's Big Move. Far from sitting idly by as the Soviet Union crumbled, Semyon Mogilevich had quickly forged extremely close ties at the highest levels of Boris Yeltsin's new Russian government and become a highly valued adjunct to Russian intelligence. Indeed, according to secretly recorded conversations between Leonid Kuchma, the second president of newly independent Ukraine, and Ihor Smeshko, the head of Ukraine's secret service, the SBU, Mogilevich was still living in Budapest, but had bought property in Moscow and had already begun delivering valuable intelligence to Yeltsin's highest-ranking security officers, all in an apparent effort to strengthen his ties to the intelligence establishment in the chaotic Russian capital. Kuchma. He, Mogilevich, has bought a dacha in Moscow. He keeps coming.
Smeshko. He has received a passport already. By the way, the passport in Moscow is in a different name. And Alexander Kozhakov, the head of Boris Yeltsin's personal security, sent two colonels to Mogilevich in Budapest in order to receive damaging information on a person. He himself did not meet them. His organization's lieutenant, Igor Korol, met these colonels and gave them the documents relating to Nordex. In 1996, then-director of the CIA, John Deutsch, called Nordex, a Vienna-based multinational company, an example of an organization associated with Russian criminal activity moving out of Russia.
Mogilevich has the most powerful analytical intelligence service, but Mogilevich himself is an extremely valuable agent of KGB, PGU. When one colonel tried to arrest Mogilevich, they told him, "Stop meddling. This is PGU elite."
PGU is the first chief directorate of the KGB SVR, which is responsible for overseeing all aspects of acquiring and managing foreign intelligence. Being tightly wired with the Kremlin, however, was not enough for Mogilevich. By 1993 or 1994, according to Litvinenko, Mogilevich had also made contact with Deputy Mayor Vladimir Putin. Little is known about how they met or exactly what transpired, but some insight into their relationship might be gleaned from transcripts of secret tape recordings made several years later, in which Ukrainian President Kuchma inquires about Mogilevich in conversation with Secret Service Chief Leonid Derkach.
Kuchma, have you found Mogilevich?
Derkach, I found him.
Kuchma, so, are you two working now?
Derkach, we're working. We have another meeting tomorrow. He arrives incognito.
Later in the discussion, Derkach revealed a few details about Mogilevich.
Derkach, he's on good terms with Putin. He and Putin have been in contact since Putin was still in Leningrad.
This apparent budding relationship with Semyon Mogilevich tied Putin to a man whose money-laundering virtuosity was vital now that a torrent of flight capital had been unleashed in post-Soviet Russia. For both men, it was Mogilevich's burgeoning operation in the United States that held so much promise. As Putin's ascent began, the Mafia moved into a powerful strategic position on the geopolitical chessboard, from which it would be able to compromise powerful political figures and businessmen in the United States, undermine financial markets, and exploit the weaknesses in a wide array of political institutions, such as campaign finance, Washington lobbying, and more. When Vyacheslav Ivankov landed at JFK Airport in March 1992, just after the fall of the Soviet Union, he was met by an Armenian war who handed him a suitcase packed with $1.5 million in cash. According to Pravda, he soon married an American woman to legalize his stay. Before long, however, he discovered that the Brighton Beach Mafia was riven by turf wars and in complete disarray. In the late 80s, Marat Balagula had used the Red Daisy gas tax scam as the basis for a vertically integrated operation that included a fleet of gasoline trucks, more than 100 gas stations, ocean-going tankers, refinery terminals in Eastern Bloc countries, and the like. But after being convicted of credit card fraud in 1986, Balagula fled the country. He was finally apprehended in Frankfurt in 1989 and served years in jail. Meanwhile, David Bogatin, likely the first Russian to launder money through Trump Tower, fled first to Austria and then Poland after the Red Daisy scam. His partner, Michael Markovitz, had been shot to death in his Rolls-Royce after assisting authorities in the investigation. Short and wiry,
Ivankov was stern-faced and bearded, with a strong jaw, sparse eyebrows, and strikingly unusual eyes that sloped noticeably downward. His slight stature, 5'4", maybe 140 pounds, notwithstanding, he projected the intense ferocity and the daunting aura of the Vory Zakonya. Even when he was spruced up for a court appearance, a blue blazer with a handkerchief in his pocket, an Oxford shirt concealing the menacing 8-pointed stars tattooed on his shoulders, Ivankov was right out of central casting as a fearsome Russian mobster. "One felt as if in the presence of Ivan the Terrible or Joseph Stalin," said one observer who saw him in New York. Before long, Ivankov became known as the most powerful Russian mobster in the United States and oversaw the mob's growth from a local extortion racket in Brooklyn's Brighton Beach to a multi-billion-dollar-a-year criminal organization. Ivankov's mandate from Mogilevich was to consolidate the Russian mafia in the U.S., to form alliances with the Cosa Nostra and other mafias, to take over smaller gangs, and to bribe politicians as part of a plan to infiltrate governments in the U.S. and elsewhere. Ruthlessly systematic, the Russians began scrutinizing the vulnerabilities of America's campaign finance system, the K Street lobbying system, Wall Street, and more. To that end, Ivankov launched a two-pronged offensive. On the one hand, with his foreboding tattoos and fearsome visage, he was the man who brought the water from the Gulag to Brighton Beach. The old-school mafia scams, shootouts, car bombs, and murders were still an important part of their operations. To help fight these gang wars, Ivankov recruited two brigades composed of 250 athletes and special forces veterans of the Afghan War who were put on $20,000-a-month retainers to kill his enemies and establish ties connecting thieves-in-law to the United States. Monya Elson, the brutal killer who had been Marat Balagula's bodyguard, was still working for Ivankov in New York, and Ivankov also used a man named Alexander Inshakov in 5 or 6 murders of top ROC, Russian organized crime, figures who got in the way. Even after he was locked up for extortion in 1996, Ivankov continued to order the murders of his underworld adversaries from his prison cell. Witnesses who dared testify against him were forced to take new identities in the Federal Witness Protection Program. FBI agents who investigated him ended up on his hit list. The same was true for journalists. When Ivankov found out that Robert Friedman was on his trail, he went so far as to send a message crafted especially for the occasion inside a Hallmark Valentine's Day card that teased, "It was easy finding a Valentine for someone like you, Friedman. You are a dirty fucking American prostitute and liar. I will fuck you and make you suck my Russian dick." America's most fearsome war signed the affectionate missive, Vyacheslav Kirillovich Ivankov. Later, Friedman found out that a $100,000 contract had been taken out on his life by Semyon Mogilevich. But to a certain extent, Ivankov's colorful depravities masked a bigger story. Just as Russia had effectively become a gangster state whose political system was governed by organized crime, so the Russian gangsters who emigrated and ran the Russian mob were now poised to infect and infiltrate a vast array of power centers in the more open, more easily manipulated corporate and political America. So it was with Ivankov, who also had steered the post-Soviet Bratva into the white-collar professional world of lawyers, stockbrokers, accountants, and the like, with offshore shell companies comprising a vertically integrated corporate empire all over the world. As a classified FBI report put it, Ivankov brings with him the tradition of hardcore Russian criminals. While not abandoning extortion, intimidation, and murder, Ivankov also incorporates more subtle and sophisticated modern methods, which enable cooperation with other groups. Over time, 30 Russian crime syndicates began operating in New York, Miami, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, and at least a dozen other cities, orchestrating insurance scams, pump-and-dump stock rip-offs that inflated stock prices, complex schemes to launder millions of dollars in flight capital pouring out of Russia, medical fraud, and jewelry heists. Ivankov used a consulting firm in Vienna to launder tens of millions of dollars, allegedly with the help of his son, Eduard Ivankov. He tried to steal diamonds in Sierra Leone. In New York, the FBI suspected that Ivankov was engaged in money laundering. Meanwhile, throughout most of the 90s, Mogilevich was based largely in Budapest, but traveled regularly to Vienna, Munich, Rome, and Athens under several different names and passports. However, he and Ivankov also kept a keen eye on developing operations in the U.S. According to FBI files, in North America, Mogilevich traveled to Toronto, Philadelphia, Miami, and New York, and went to L.A. at least five times between May 1992 and November 1994. There, he met with Vladimir Berkovich, a key Mogilevich lieutenant, who, according to FBI files, arranged contract murders, bringing in hitmen from Russia under tourist visas, out of the Palm Terrace restaurant. There were deals for a Russian restaurant in Denver, real estate in the Rocky Mountains, a car dealership in Houston, which the FBI asserted was for money laundering, diamond thefts in Sierra Leone. When the Russians moved into Miami, Ivankov allegedly became a silent partner in Porky's, a Miami strip club owned by Russian mobster Ludwig Feinberg, also known as Tarzan, thanks to his muscled torso and long mane of hair. Feinberg helped strike a deal with the Cali cartel in Colombia to provide heroin and money laundering in exchange for Cali's cocaine. These were not small-time transactions. At the time, Russian military hardware was absurdly easy to come by if you knew the right people in the former Soviet Empire. And that meant everything, from armored personnel carriers to submarines. At one point, Feinberg was in talks with Colombian drug lords to sell them a submarine to help smuggle the illicit drugs and money, complete with a Russian crew of 18 men. Before it could be finalized, however, the deal was busted by the Drug Enforcement Administration. In large part, Mogilevich's success grew out of the fact that he had cultivated close ties to the powers that be in the post-Soviet world. He had operatives who infiltrated the Hungarian National Police, and in Prague, where he also had a major presence, the Czech police. He was wired into the intelligence services of both Russia and Ukraine at the highest levels. One of the key people helping Mogilevich in Budapest was Dietmar Klodo, a longtime associate of Mogilevich with a colorful history as a mercenary in Rhodesia and as a supporter of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviets. A suspected international arms and drug trafficker, Klodo was sentenced to 10 years in prison for his role in a series of bombings in Hungary in the 1990s, and was extradited to Germany in 2005, where he was wanted on charges of murder, bank robbery, and other serious crimes. According to an article by Russian journalist Anastasia Kirilenko on a website called Hungarian Spectrum, in 1994, Klodo said he was entrusted by Mogilevich with the delivery of large sums of money to various top political officials in Hungary, among whom was Minister of the Interior Sándor Pinter. On one such occasion, Klodo received a suitcase with approximately 1 million Deutschmarks, with instructions to give it to an unnamed political figure who was coming by to pick it up. As Klodo recalled, when the man arrived, he didn't want to come into my house. I told him, listen to me. I have that damned money in a suitcase. I don't want to go out on the street with this suitcase. I don't care. If you refuse to come in, I will give it back to Mr. Mogilevich. I don't care. Of course, Clodo did not tell the man why he wanted the transaction to take place indoors, namely that there was a hidden camera among his books that would record the transfer.
"I wasn't interested in who this man was," said Clodo. "It was only after the elections that I understood that this young man was Viktor Orbán from Fidesz, the right-wing populist party in Hungary. Orbán went on to become Prime Minister of Hungary from 1998 to 2002, and again from 2010 to the present, but there is no way to verify Clodo's account." For a master of money laundering like Mogilevich, banks were essential, and in 1994 he infiltrated and later took over Incombank, one of the largest private banks in Russia, allegedly via a secret deal with its chairman, Vladimir Vinogradov. In the UK, he had first staked out turf in the early 90s, laundering large sums of cash, allegedly from activities ranging from arms dealing to prostitution, extortion, and drug trafficking, through Arbat and Aragon, the companies he had launched with Ivankov and Mikhailov in the Channel Islands. In 1995, however, after large amounts of money started going to the company's lawyers, London's Metropolitan Police raided their homes and seized millions from the Royal Bank of Scotland. No charges were filed, but the companies were dissolved, and Mogilevich was banned from Britain. Increasingly, Mogilevich focused his energies on the corporate world, and not just in Russia and Ukraine, but also the United States. To make his dreams a reality, he put together a network of white-collar professionals who would propel the Semyon Mogilevich organization to another level entirely. He cultivated young Russian businessmen who had expertise in creating shell companies to launder money. He found bankers who made it possible to launder money on a multi-billion dollar level on an ongoing basis. A decade earlier, the Russians had deconstructed the system of gasoline tax distribution in the United States, zeroed in on its vulnerabilities, and put together a virtually foolproof scheme to steal billions of dollars. Now they prepared to take on Wall Street, America's campaign finance system, the world of K Street lobbyists, and any politicians who were ready for hire, all in a widespread effort to have as much power and money in their pockets as possible. But Mogilevich's ascent was not without setbacks. By 1994, Mogilevich's Incombank was able to have virtually daily interaction with the Bank of New York, BONY, one of the largest banks in the United States, meaning that he finally had direct access to mainstream international banks to launder billions of dollars. Through Incombank, Mogilevich separately acquired a substantial interest in Sukhoi, a large manufacturer of Russia's military aircraft. But a British investigation codenamed Operation Sword revealed that Arbat International, one of the Channel Island firms Mogilevich had started in the early 90s, was at the center of a web of companies in London and New York, through which Mogilevich laundered as much as $10 billion. Meanwhile, by 1995, Mogilevich was in the midst of a heated dispute with longtime ally Sergei Mikhailov. The reason, according to Interpol files, was that Mikhailov had ordered Mogilevich to transfer about $5 million to the general security of the Soltsova Group. The matter came to a head at a meeting in the Czech Republic on May 31st of that year, the purpose of which, according to Interpol files, was to split up newly discovered routes for smuggling gold and jewelry, a new route of cocaine smuggling from South America to Moscow, and heroin from the CIS countries to Western Europe and the United States. It happened to be Averin's birthday, and in true Bratva fashion, the meeting took place at the U Halabu, a Prague restaurant Mogilevich owned and used as a money laundering center, with strippers, hookers, and a guest list that included Mikhailov, Averin, Mogilevich, and everyone who was anyone in the Russian mafia. "They were having an elaborate dinner and entertainment,"
Special Agent Robert Levinson of the FBI told the BBC. They had a Russian singer and a comic, and they had some cabaret entertainers, and everyone was having a very good time for themselves. Then, while the performances were still underway, the Czech Republic's organized crime SWAT team suddenly came into the restaurant, jumped on the stage, and armed with machine guns, ordered the crowd not to move. At first, everyone was transfixed, thinking it was part of the show. According to FBI files, what they didn't know, however, was that before the festivities got underway, an unidentified Russian delivered an anonymous letter to the chief of police in Budapest, Hungary, in which it was alleged that Semyon Mogilevich was to be assassinated that evening at the summit meeting in Prague. Slowly, the partygoers realized that the SWAT team had foiled an assassination attempt on Mogilevich. As for Mogilevich, he had been tipped off and was nowhere to be found. Mogilevich knew he was dealing with some very, very treacherous people, said Levinson. They'd kill him in an instant. In the wake of the Prague fiasco, Mogilevich, Mikhailov, and other alleged Russian mobsters were banned from the Czech Republic, effectively shutting down operations there. In June 1995, Ivankov had been nabbed for extortion and held without bail. He was later sentenced to 9 years and 7 months in jail. On occasion, there were shootouts between rival gangsters and internecine warfare. But all that was the price of doing business. By some accounts, Mogilevich was already said to be worth over $100 million, and money was rolling in. At the same time, with Ivankov overseeing operations from his cell in upstate New York, Mogilevich had begun to consolidate operations in the U.S. while maintaining major business interests in Europe. He had major holdings in the Hungarian arms industry. He had managed to steal millions of dollars of Soviet military equipment that had been left behind in East Germany when the Soviet Union dissolved. Between weapons trafficking, assassinations, prostitution, drug trafficking, dealing in precious gems and stolen art, extortion and money laundering, cash was pouring in from all over the world. In the history of the American Mafia, there have been a handful of summit meetings at which rival gangs sort out how to divide operations, such as loan sharking, drug dealing, gambling, prostitution, and, of course, the resulting spoils. Among the most famous is the 1957 meeting in the sleepy hamlet of Apalachin, New York, that was raided by state and local cops, resulting in more than 60 underworld bosses being detained and indicted. The Bratva meeting in Prague had played out differently for Mogilevich than the Apalachin meeting did for the American mob. He and his allies had been forced out of the Czech Republic, but they lived to fight another day. Moreover, vital issues were still unresolved. So in October 1995, Mogilevich attended a summit meeting of Russian crime figures in the Tel Aviv office of Boris Bichstein, a flamboyant, politically connected Russian-Canadian businessman who ran Sibeco SA and had close ties both to the KGB and Sergei Mikhailov, with whom he partnered in a Belgian company called MAB International. Others who were present included Mikhailov partner Viktor Averin, Ukrainian media mogul Vadim Rabinovich, who had ties to the arms trade and had spent 7 years in jail for black market ventures, several other Ukrainian businessmen, and of course, Semyon Mogilevich. Rabinovich had run the Kiev office of Nordex, an arms company allegedly tied to the mafia that had brokered the sale of Scud missiles from North Korea to Iraq. While they were in Israel, the group traveled around the country, including a visit to a shooting range. Israeli officials had telephone coverage of their hotel rooms and detected calls to Russia, Hungary, and Paris. According to the FBI, they did not appear to practice communication security, freely discussing business over the telephone. Now that the Soviet Union was dead and gone, they had gone global. Hundreds of billions of dollars in natural resources were there for the taking, but they had to figure out how to split their booty. And so a settlement was reached whereby Mogilevich paid Mikhailov the disputed $5 million, but in return got something far more valuable. The key subject of the meeting in Tel Aviv and subsequent gatherings of the Russian mobsters was how to divide spoils in Ukraine among the criminal gangs, especially Ukraine's energy trade. With more than 50 million Ukrainians overwhelmingly dependent on Russia for such an essential commodity as gas, especially given Ukraine's frigid winters, an intermediary would be in a strong position to dictate whatever terms he liked. Of course, that meant asserting real political power at the highest levels of government in Ukraine and Russia. Even more important, in the long run, it also necessitated having access to power in the United States. Chapter 9. Turn of the Screw. In the fall of 1996, after years of nonstop wrangling with creditors over billions of dollars in debt, Donald Trump's comeback began. One of many reasons for the delay had been Trump Castle, one of the most troubled properties among his Atlantic City casinos. All of them were failing, but the castle was the ugly stepmother. It had been that way for years. In 1990, after Trump built the stupendously extravagant Trump Taj Mahal, with its minarets and carved elephants, the Taj began to cannibalize the nearby Trump Castle so much that it almost fell into the hands of bondholders. It was saved only when Fred Trump, Donald's father, famously bought $3.3 million in poker chips and didn't use them, thereby giving his son's casino a questionable loan. The following year, however, the castle's decline in revenue was so dire that the New Jersey Casino Control Commission ruled that the resort was at risk of losing its license. Trump's casino empire had so much debt, at such high interest rates, there was almost no chance he would succeed. Then came the bankruptcies, with four trips to bankruptcy court. In the end, bondholders had to accept more than a $1.5 billion loss, while Trump continued to collect a big salary, bonuses, and other payments. Through it all, Trump managed to stay in the game and persuade bankers and bondholders to refinance his casinos in a way that allowed him to keep majority ownership. Then, finally, on September 30th, stockholders of Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts, his publicly traded company, agreed to buy Trump Castle, the weakest of his Atlantic City properties, for $485.7 million. That meant stockholders paid Trump more than $130 million in stock and nearly $1 million in cash, and assumed $354.8 million in debt. It took 2 years of hard work, but now everything is put together into one beautiful, simple, lovely, substantial company, Trump said. People are shocked when they look at the numbers because the numbers are terrific. The numbers are just huge. Even his critics were impressed. His turnabout is a classic, casino analyst Marvin Roffman told Playboy. It is the biggest comeback I've ever seen. Donald Trump, financially speaking, has come back from the dead. Roffman had been fired from his Wall Street firm under pressure from Trump for refusing to apologize for a report critical of Trump. Immediately after reading Roffman's analysis of the Taj Mahal, Trump had sent a letter to Janney Montgomery Scott, the investment firm that employed Roffman, and demanded that Roffman issue a public retraction of his assessment of the Taj, or in the absence of such a retraction, that Janney fire Roffman. He was worse than broke. Stephen Bollenbach, a corporate salvage expert who helped rescue Trump's empire, told Playboy's Mark Bowden. He was losing money every day, and he was already hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. This time, Roffman said, he has real net worth. But cash never lasted long in Donald Trump's hands. As if to prove that he hadn't lost his taste for profligacy, less than a month later, in October 1996, Trump bought three beauty pageants, Miss Universe, Miss USA, and Miss Teen USA, from ITT. As is often the case with Trump, the exact amount of the transaction is unclear. In The Art of the Comeback, he wrote that his winning bid was $10 million. But later, he couldn't resist changing the narrative to make reporters think he had gotten a steal and paid only $2 million. Regardless of the price, less than a week later, with this new calling card in hand, and whatever cachet came with it, Trump returned to Moscow for the first time in nearly a decade, with visions of yet another Trump Tower still in his head. Even though there's no evidence that Trump had direct contact with Ivankov or Mogilevich, throughout his three-day stay in Russia in November 1996, Trump and his entourage were escorted around Moscow by people with alleged connections to them. This time, Donald was accompanied by his friend, New York real estate developer Howard Lorber, and Lorber's business partner, Bennett LeBeau. Though relatively low profile among Trump's associates, Lorber was an important figure in the Trump administration in that he introduced Trump to David Friedman, who became Trump's ambassador to Israel. In addition, Friedman's former partner, Mark Kasowitz, became Trump's lawyer. Lorber was the president of the Brook Group. In 2000, the Brook Group was renamed the Vector Group, whose holdings included Liggett Ducat Limited, formerly known as Liggett & Myers, America's third-largest tobacco company, and major real estate assets in both New York and Moscow. LeBeau was founder and chairman. Having started out in the early Wild West days of post-Soviet privatization, the duo had already forged some interesting relationships. LeBeau had begun partnering with Vadim Rabinovich, the pro-Russia-Ukrainian oligarch who had spent 7 years in jail for embezzlement. Even though Rabinovich says he was jailed on trumped-up charges, the U.S. has barred his entry into this country. "You will find accusations against me in the U.S., Rabinovich told The Forward. "In Israel, some say I am connected to the mafia. In Ukraine, they say I am Mossad agent. If you find this kind of nonsense interesting, I don't." Only a month before Trump, Lorber, and LeBeau's Moscow visit, Rabinovich had participated in the Tel Aviv summit meeting at which Mogilevich was granted control of the Ukraine energy trade. Once Trump and his entourage arrived in Moscow, they were shown around town by its mayor, Yuri Lushkov. As John Byerly, the American ambassador to Russia, saw it, Lushkov was the embodiment of the Russian political dilemma, in that his political power was both marred and fueled by the shadowy world of corrupt business practices, and a system in which almost everyone, at every level, is involved in some form of corruption or criminal behavior. As reported by the liberal newspaper Novaya Gazeta, Mayor Lushkov was alleged to be deeply in bed with Mogilevich, Ivankov, and company. In fact, according to a classified cable Ambassador Byerly wrote, "Lushkov used criminal money to support his rise to power and has been involved with bribes and deals regarding lucrative construction contracts throughout Moscow." Source redacted told us that Lushkov's friends and associates, including crime boss Vyacheslav Ivankov and reputedly corrupt Duma deputy Joseph Kobzon, are bandits. Through his billionaire wife, Elena Baturina, Lushkov also had family ties to Sistema. More specifically, Baturina's brother-in-law, Vladimir Yevtushenko, was head of Sistema, a company that privatized Moscow real estate and gas, and according to Novaya Izvestia, was tied to Mogilevich's companies in the Channel Islands and the Solntsev crime gang. According to The Guardian, the couple have vehemently denied the accusations as total rubbish. On the occasion of Donald Trump's return to Russia, Mayor Lushkov was effectively giving Trump the keys to Moscow as part of a serious overture from the Yeltsin government to build a Trump Tower-like complex in the Russian capital. According to TASS, the Russian press agency, Trump began negotiations